My name is Paul Rogers. I'm a retired pastor from Minneapolis. My wife Camille is there in the red sweatshirt. And we'll be having this 9 o'clock also tomorrow, Thursday and Friday. And then on Wednesday, it'll be at 11 o'clock. There's some big event for the first day of school on Wednesday. So we'll have the Bible study 9, 9, 11, 9, and 9. Let's open with a prayer. We ask for your presence, O God. Let us drink from your word. Let us be enlightened and nourished and watered with your grace. Amen. Amen. The theme for the summer comes from Ezekiel, where the river flows, life abounds. And I'm assuming that part of that, part of the inspiration for that theme came from redoing the mine stuff, thinking of the stream that flows through here, and the toxicity, and whether or not life can abound in that, and the hope that there is that after everything is done, it will be a stream with pure life-giving water. And then, of course, we can have all kinds of ways to understand that. And I think I looked at some of the descriptions from the Bible studies through the summer, and some were very exegetical, starting with the Hebrew in that verse. That's not what you'll be getting here. I hope you're not anticipating a real heavy exegetical study for the week, but rather we'll be looking at five different passages that have water as imagery. An imagery for a variety of different things, all related to life. And in each case, we'll talk first about the scripture, and then you folks will do some work on that. And then we'll be looking at the history of the Lutheran Church of East Germany and some aspects of its life between the beginning of the Cold War up until 1990 or 91, at the time of the reunification of the two Germanies. And then, once again, you'll be asked to have some discussion about implications of that history, together with that, with the verse, for our context today. So today's verse, Matthew 5:45, God sends rain on the just and the unjust. Now, some of you have Bibles, you may have looked it up. For those who haven't looked it up yet, do you have in your mind where that might come from? Where is that verse? What section is it in? Sermon on the Mount? And what's the context for the Sermon on the Mount, for that verse? What's Jesus talking about? Starting with verse 43, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father in heaven, for he makes the sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers and sisters, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. So, we have this context of just and unjust, of God having the sun rise on both groups and the rain fall on both groups. And if God does that, then we are to love both groups. So, I've got some questions for you. If you would just, on your own, have some groups and discuss these questions. What is the nature of the relationship between God and the unrighteous? Secondly, what should be the relationship between a faith community, not just individuals, but a faith community and the unrighteous? And then thirdly, if God lets rain fall upon the righteous and the unrighteous, and if we are to love our neighbor, would it make sense to have this be an image, that our task is to let love fall upon our enemies or upon those whom we define unrighteous? So, just little groups, go at it. Let's say about 8 minutes of that. Okay, let's get to the next section. You were asking about, somebody asked about how do we define unrighteous. One could say that trying to define unrighteous means to identify which group against which we have prejudice. It always sounds prejudicial to name anybody as unrighteous. But that'll get clarified a little bit. You might also remember A Tale of Two Cities. And I can't remember the name of the woman who sat and crocheted the history of what was going on.
She's back here. Well,
she's all over here.
We've got two of them here. So be careful. Be careful what you say. Three of yeah. us are
four
men. We've got some good recorders here. Well, no matter what you said, we're going to be going on now to the history of the East German Church and see how they maybe applied this in their effort to be faithful. But first, a little bit of church history. Reformation is dated 1517, 500 years ago soon. And the German church, of course, is gearing up for all kinds of things. And for example, the church district of Leipzig, Germany, and the state of Saxony, former East Germany, they're expecting hordes of Americans to show up during the year 2017. But it's good to remember 1517 is the date we choose for the Reformation, when Luther put the theses on the door of the church. But it didn't all go slick after that, and there was a series of wars shortly after that called the Smalcaldic Wars, and they ended up with a treaty, the Peace of Augsburg, in 1555. And then later on, more war broke out, and then we had the 30 Years' War going to 1648. Some would say that the 30 Years' War saved the Protestant Church of all of Europe, not just Germany. How many of you are Swedish background? Gustavus Adolphus, of course, led Swedish armies against Catholic armies and was very successful in that effort. So some would say that Gustavus Adolphus was the savior of the Reformation. Some of the Germans, he's buried near Leipzig, in a little village near Leipzig. Some of the Germans would say that he wasn't careful always against whom he was fighting, so that a lot of the locals who were Lutherans, who were followers of the Reformation, had been slain as the armies went through. But anyway, in 1648, at the end of the 30 Years' War, there was another treaty that covered not just the German states, but most of Europe. It included France, which had gone through, of course, their own turmoil. It included the Habsburg dynasty, the Austro-Hungarian kingdom. In both of those, in a limited way concerning Lutherans and Catholics at the Peace of Augsburg, and the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, it included also the Reformed Church, the followers of Calvin. There was a phrase that was adopted in both of those, quius regio, aius religio. Whoever is the ruler gets to choose the religion. So you had these states that where the king or the prince or the duke decided what everybody would be. So in the areas of Germany along the Rhine, the lower Rhine, those were Catholic. The areas north of that were mostly Lutheran, but with some Reformed. Later on, they became so-called union churches, a combination of Reformed and Union. But part of the history then of the Church of Eastern Germany was this heritage that that whoever ruled determined the religion of the realm. Secondly, 1803 and again in 1848, the French played a big role in this after the French Revolution. There were other treaties that guaranteed the church's ability to tax the members, so that membership or financing of the church did not depend on the generosity of the members, but rather the church was seen by those rulers who had determined what they would be, Roman Catholic, Lutheran, or Reformed. Those rulers saw the church as something that was stabilizing and part of the stability of the whole nation. In many cases, especially in the Germans, the pastors, evangelical pastors, both Reformed and Lutheran, were civil servants in the state and were paid by the state. But the church then could tax the members and require a tax to be paid in order to be a member of the church. They meant primarily in order to have a child baptized by the church, have a wedding in the church, or be buried by the church. In order to have those things happen, you had to be a member of the church, and to be a member of the church, you had to pay your taxes. So, we're often critical of that, but that is an ancient history. I mean, that's the way the Lutheran Church grew up in Europe, was that it was determined by the ruler, whether you'd be Lutheran or a Catholic, and you had to be ready to pay your taxes. After 1848, some of the German states, at that time there wasn't a German nation, there were several different kingdoms and states. Some of them started to collect that tax with state taxes and then turn it over to the church. That meant that the experience of the members was that that the state, the church and the state were the same. And even today in Germany, when you pay income tax, the income tax is taken out. In Germany, you don't have the problem that we do of having the day when you have to file. You don't file unless there's some particular reason to file, typically that there's some reason that you're going to get a lot back. But taxes are taken out for everybody, and church taxes are taken out also from your paycheck by the government, and the government takes out a portion of that as functioning as a collection agency, and then turns the rest over to the church. But that is an old pattern going back originally to 1803, that the issue of church taxes. Now, one more thing. In 1870, a bunch of American states weren't states yet. They were part of the territories. Bismarck was the Chancellor of Germany and established already then Social Security, for example. He also unified the various various states of Germany into a kind of a federation of states. So even today, it's the Federal Republic of Germany. And he had his eyes on parts of France that had been typically German, so they spoke often the German language, but they belonged to France. So he went to war against France in 1871, the Franco-Prussian War. And that started a pattern. So we had the Franco-Prussian War in 1871. And then they were relatively free of war for a while, and then there was the First World War, the Second World War, and then the Cold War. During this time, there was a devastation and destruction of Europe, of Central Europe, that we have trouble imagining. Comparisons are dangerous, but you know how shocking it was when, whatever the final number was, 3,000 people died on 9/11. There are many cities in Germany that had a huge portion die during a war. There's one city, Heilbronn, in southern Germany, in an area called Swabia, near Stuttgart. In 1944, it had 49,000 residents. Many of them were gone, off to war. And the Brits bombed the central part of the city of 49,000. And in a 25-minute bombing period in early December 1944, 7,000 people were killed. 7,000 out of 49 killed in one half hour. And of course, that was the experience of much of Europe during the First World War, during the Second World War, and then during the Cold War, we had this huge buildup of atomic weapons, soldiers all over, thousands of soldiers in the West and in the East. And during that period in Europe, therefore, there was a development culturally and psychologically of hopelessness, a lack of meaning. Life is meaningless. In a negative sense, existentialism became rampant of saying, I exist and all that's important is what I experience and how I interpret that. And what is important is what happens for the moment. Many of us are of an age that we saw the Ingmar Bergman films. Bergman articulated that feeling very well. Or Camus, the French author, was especially articulate in what's called nihilism, where nothing is important. So the church found itself, both in Western Germany and Eastern Germany, found itself facing a population that said nothing is meaningful, there's no meaning in life, no purpose in life, no hope. The church had to decide then what its task was. And besides that, at least up until 1949, in both West and East Germany, about 95% of the population was a member of the church and was baptized. So the idea of evangelism was difficult doctrinally. How do we decide whom to convert? Because 95% of our population is baptized in our churches. So the church decided two things. One, it would continue what it had begun back in the mid-1800s, of social service. So they have social service agencies that have been around since the mid-1800s. That's where, for example, group homes for retarded persons were developed, where they weren't just housed, but they were cared for and given some training and sometimes given work to do. That came out of the late 1800s in Germany, came out of Lutheran churches. So that was one thing they said, we'll continue serving with those agencies. But also then, we will try to preach and, in a sense, evangelize by giving hope and meaning. And we Americans have poo-pooed that, but we haven't had that history of having one out of seven people in our cities killed in half an hour's worth of bombing. We've not experienced that. But that's been their history. And then we get to the Cold War, and East Germany is cut off from West Germany, and West Germans can't go to East Germany. Americans and Brits and French could, but not West Germans, and East Germans could not go to the West, at least not easily. So they were isolated. Interestingly, in some areas, well, the whole East German church technically belonged to the Evangelical Church of Germany. So it was all one church, except that they couldn't go back and forth. And it was most evident in Berlin. The Evangelical Church of Berlin-Brandenburg had its bishop sitting in West Berlin, but the bishop couldn't visit the church. So Berlin-Brandenburg was this little tiny part of West Berlin. And then all around that area to the north and to the east was Brandenburg. And Bishop Otto Debelius couldn't even go there to visit the majority of the members. And he also had another problem, that he was very right-wing politically. He has a rather infamous section in a book where he said, the East German government is an illegitimate government, and therefore its rules are illegitimate, and therefore if you're driving a car and you come upon a red light, you can ignore it because it's illegitimate. Well, you can imagine how the East Germans felt about having that be their bishop. So in 1969, the East Germans formed their own church. They separated as a church from the West and formed the Federation of Evangelical Churches in the German Democratic Republic and formed their own Federation of Churches. And then 2 years later, 1971, they started to define themselves. And they decided in 1971 that they would claim that they as a church were not to be against, their purpose was not to overthrow the government. They said, technically, for witness and service in the German Democratic Republic, a community of churches, remember it's a federation of churches in different states, and some are Reformed, some are Lutheran, some are Union. A community of churches needs to give careful consideration to its location in the society, not beside it or against it. So the West criticized that, saying they're just giving in, they're a puppet for the government. But they decided they had to take seriously the realities of where they were. And where they were was East Germany, a communist government, a dictatorship. And then they decided, what does it mean to do that? And they decided they should be a church for others. And they took that phrase from Dietrich Bonhoeffer in one of the later passages in the book called Letters and Papers from Prison. He sends to his friend, he sends an outline for a book that he wanted to write. And of course, it never got written. but he has a description of the first three chapters of the book. And in that, he said, the church is church only when it is there for others. In order to begin, it must give its property to those who suffer. Pastors must live exclusively from the free will offering of the congregations. Remember, church tax, civil servant. The pastors must live exclusively from the free will offering of the congregations, or even practice a secular occupation. The church, and this is really critical, the church must participate in the worldly tasks of human community, not ruling, but rather helping and serving.
And that's the East Germans.
Pardon?
This is the East
Germans. This is the East Germans. Later, one of the ways it did that, for example, was to try to imagine now East Germany filled with Soviet troops, filled with East German troops, filled with what they call the Stasi. That comes from the word Staatssicherheitspolizei, the state security police. They had developed a huge system of informers, and within that context, the German church in the early mid 70s passed a statement in an assembly calling on the government to allow for conscientious objection. And imagine that. Mm-hmm. So when they said serve, not rule, but serve, they were willing as a group to make themselves very vulnerable for the sake of what they thought would be justice and truth. In the passage we read from Matthew, it talks about pray for those who persecute you. It was common, for example, for the Stasi to use all kinds of evil means to develop their informers. For example, in the 60s in Berlin, the Lutheran World Federation had an office, and they would smuggle medications into the East, especially to pastors' families, because the government would not allow often, well, sometimes there were medications that weren't available at all for anybody in the East, but sometimes they were available, but would not, the pastors' families, because they were pastors' families, wouldn't be allowed to get the medications they needed. And the Lutheran World Federation then would smuggle medications in with agreed upon times and locations for the drop, so that somebody in a pastor's family or other Christian family would be able to have medication necessary for whatever illness it was. If a young person chose to be confirmed and chose not to go through the communist youth dedication ceremony, and chose to go to the church youth group and not to the communist young leaders group, that meant often, nearly always, that a child was not allowed to attend the level of school called gymnasium that was pre-university, and was not allowed to get into a university. So to say, I'm going to get confirmed, and I'm going to go to the youth group at church, meant I'll not be able to follow my dream. Big choices. That wasn't just Germany. We have a woman here with her son from Hungary, Sylvia Voss. She had the same thing. And then there she said it was so strict, everybody went through the communist youth dedication. She did too. But she also got confirmed, but they lived in a city of 500,000, and for her confirmation, they went to a village where nobody knew them, and there was a very, very tiny confirmation service in a Lutheran church in a small village, because they didn't dare have anything happen in a city where people knew them. That was just everyday life. Pray for those who persecute you. So in many ways, the church knew very much who the unrighteous and who the enemies were. But the church decided our task is to let love reign upon everybody. So they went about trying to serve the nation and trying to be agents of love and grace to this nation where they were being persecuted by the government of the nation. Any quick questions on that? Yeah.
Well, maybe it's too big a question in a way, or it needs too big of a talk, but I'm just wondering, how did that East German Lutheran Church survive in numbers or in depth? And then what had been when the wall came down, what was the impact on what's happening with it today?
You know? Well, we'll get there before the week is up.
Okay.
We'll kind of move from 1971 to now.
Okay.
To the first part, how did it get through? Remember I had said 95% of the population was a Christian before 1949. I don't know the current data, but for example, in Leipzig, in the Leipzig district of the Lutheran Church, in 2006, they had 18% unemployment, and 15% of the population belonged to a church. And that was primarily the Lutheran Church, but 15% belonged to any church. So the Lutheran, the Christian community became a very small minority. But during that whole period, they still had worship. They had difficulty replacing Bibles and catechisms and hymnals. So the Luther World Federation would negotiate with the government. For example, they didn't even often have nice paper like for a Bible, to have the thin, fine paper for a Bible. That wasn't even available, surely not with East German cash. So the LWF would negotiate with the government to provide a certain amount of the kind of paper necessary for the church to produce Bibles and hymnals, but it would be only a small portion of the total amount of paper they would provide. So the LWF provided paper for other uses, but in agreement that the church could then print Bibles and catechisms and hymnals. Or sometimes when it was paper that was available, the LWF agreed to pay Western currency, hard cash, for those things, because the Eastern currency was almost worthless towards the end. So that's one way that it happened. Also the LWF, through contributions from, in those days, the LCA and the ALC, the LWF provided occasionally funds for refurbishing a church, also provided funds, supplementary funds for pastor salaries. Remember I said a civil servant, the pastors were guaranteed salaries. It was the same in Czechoslovakia and in Hungary. So they were classified for salaries the same as teachers. But by 1983 in Czechoslovakia, for example, teachers were making four times as much as pastors were. And pastors were living technically in poverty, even though the Constitution guaranteed support through the state. So they made it through faith and through some important help from the outside. Real quickly, yes.
I think this is a very quick question. I believe you said that in 1959 the East German Church did two things. They decided they were trying to deal with all this stuff, and one was the social service. Did you say two things? But I didn't hear you mention the other thing.
The other thing was this matter of being a church for others.
Okay.
And in that case, it was all the churches that were saying social service, but also preaching meaning and hope
okay.
to a population or a culture that was without without much hope. Yeah. One more, maybe? Yes.
You mentioned that the people are taxed in Germany, and a percentage goes to the church.
Yeah.
Can people protest that and not have to pay the tax?
Only if they don't want to bury Grandpa in the church cemetery. Yeah.
So are all. Oh.
And the percentage of membership in the church is dropping. So that there's the assumption that the whole Church of Germany will at some point be like we are. Now there are these privileges. The state collects the membership fee, which is called the church tax. Religious instruction still takes place in the school. So when I was a pastor in a German congregation, I had to give instruction to fourth graders in a public school. Now the children can choose between religious instruction or ethics. And fewer are choosing religious instruction, and more are choosing ethics. But that's still part of the culture. Now, they define their context and define their mission. So I'd like to have you get back in the same groups and talk about these things. What is our context? How would we define our context? Who are the unrighteous, or who are the enemy? And what is our mission? But if we're to use the imagery that we're to love the enemy, or love the unrighteous, or as it were, let love rain down upon everyone in our community, then how do we, as a church faith community, how do we love? We've got 14 minutes. Let's work for 10, and then real quickly have a summary. Go ahead. Yeah. So as I was listening, the conversations were going, covering the whole spectrum. That was fun to hear. Thanks for that. In general, this will be the pattern for the week, that we'll have the biblical discussion, historical example, and then our own contextual discussion. The next 4 days we'll have these themes: peace, justice, order, and forgiveness. And for tomorrow, it's peace, coming from Psalm 23:2, God leads us beside still waters. And you can do some thinking on that. There are several questions that are hopefully stimulating that will come out of that. If any of you want to keep talking now, we can do that, but the time would be over in 2 minutes. So I would just be ready to welcome whoever wants to come back tomorrow, and if you find it worthwhile, tell others, and we'll continue this kind of basic theme and conversation. Anything really in the last minute, anything that just kind of struck one of the groups in your discussion, or an individual from the hour? Would any of our knitters want to tell us what they're knitting? No. Yes?
I was just struck when you started talking about how much of our history is war. Christians, and it's so disturbing to me that Christ's message was so opposite of that, and yet that's how we do it.
I'll probably mention tomorrow that a group of congregations in Minneapolis ordered signs, "Pray for Peace," in 2002. And we put ours up in our front lawn, and it's still there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't even know what it is.
Yeah.
No.
We've been in endless war.
So we will be talking a bit about that tomorrow, and then about some very particular things of the German Lutheran youth movement from beginning in 1981 tomorrow.
Can Paul, can we assume that this won't be the kind of peace that is in the phrase, the peace of God that passes all up?
We have an apron.
We're going to have Ludifus Eucharist or something?
No.
Oh, gosh, I hope
not. It won't be spelled I-E-C-E, and it won't be spelled C-O-D.
In Norway and in some other countries around that, they still are taxing.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Norway is on the way out.
It's on the way out now. They're wondering what's going to happen to the church.
Yeah, that's interesting. That after the change of government, after reunification, not only did the West say, now you can be part of us and this is the way we do things, but the Western Church said to the Eastern Lutherans, now you're part of us, and we'll keep doing things the way we always have. And some of us thought they had had 40 years of experience of being a minority church and basically what we call a free church, that is, a church that is dependent on itself for everything. And they'd had experience in that. And what it meant to be a church in an obviously secular context. In the West, it's still more than half of the country belongs to the Christian church, maybe still at 60%. But in the East, it was obvious this is the contemporary context for the church. So some of us thought the West should have said to the Eastern churches, now, how can you help us? Because you've already gone through some of the things that we're facing. But unfortunately, they didn't do that. On the other hand, the Eastern Church is finding its way. But we'll be getting into that in the coming days. Just so you know, the Minneapolis Area Synod of the ELCA has as its partner, as part of the Companion Synod program, the Church District of Leipzig. So, and I've been since 1998 the coordinator of that program. So much of what we're having today has come out of getting acquainted with, in a very intimate way, with some of the persons and the history of the Church of Leipzig. Plus, I lived in Berlin in the 60s for 1 year and was involved in, for example, in some of those medication drops. I didn't smuggle the medication, but I took messages to the pastors to say where and when will the next drop be. And then in the 80s, I administered the program that provided the paper and the subsidies and those things out of Geneva. So much of what you're hearing is my own biography. It's been my life, but as an outsider rather than as one of them. See you tomorrow.
Okay.